KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The rest of the sunken structure will remain in the river until the NTSB is satisfied with that piece. Then the other beams can be removed, making way for the building of a temporary span to replace the portion of the bridge that collapsed. State officials have said the temporary section could be in place as the bridge open by mid-June. A Seattle City Council committee could decide next month that it wants public campaign finance on the ballot. The council would ask Seattle voters to decide whether city elections should be paid for with tax dollars and private campaign contributions. Campaign spending would be capped. Advocates of public campaign financing says it diminishes the power of big money in elections. Opponents say it curbs First Amendment rights. Other cities such as San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York have adopted public campaign financing. Portland had a public campaign system, but voters repealed it in 2010. The Seattle City Council is scheduled to discuss its proposal this afternoon. The Island County Sheriff's Office says a holiday weekend landslide on Whidbey Island isn't threatening any homes. No evacuations have been ordered following the 300-foot slide north of Langley yesterday. That slide is not in the same area as a huge landslide in March that knocked one home off its foundation and threatened dozens more. I'm Lisa Brooks, KUOW News.
That's the news. Now, what about the weather? Well, it's 56 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. Forecast says showers likely today with a high of 62. Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. How do Americans feel about economic inequality and the measures proposed to address it? That's the topic of Leslie McCall's new book, The Undeserving Rich. Hear her conversation with KUOW's Ross Reynolds today at noon. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:06.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. How do you deal with an impending mass extinction, and what does that term actually mean anyway? Science writer Annalee Newitz has some good news about that, if there is such a thing. She's going to come up later this morning. Also, gardeners are with us to answer your gardening questions. Kathy McMorris Rogers represents Washington State's 5th Congressional District. It covers a vast swath of eastern Washington. She's the Republican Party's 4th ranking leader, the party's top ranking woman in Congress. We spoke earlier this morning. State leaders are just starting to figure out how to cope with the collapse of the I-5 bridge in Skagit County, one of thousands of bridges across the country that are aging or potentially faulty. I asked her what role the federal government should play in funding infrastructure upgrades.
I, too, have been closely monitoring the situation of the I-5 bridge, and it is of national consequence what happened, and I think it's important that we look at the bridge. It is true that we have an aging infrastructure in America, and it highlights the importance of the transportation infrastructure package. There was a bill that passed last year, last Congress, signed by the president for a two-year package. Normally, we pass a five-year transportation package, and I think the bridge only reinforces how important it is that we are taking steps to meet important transportation needs in the country.
I know that some people have talked about increasing a federal gas tax to help fund this. Do you think that's the way to go?
Well, I think that we need to look at how we are going to meet important transportation infrastructure needs moving forward. And there's several different revenue options that people have been considering. It's a question is what can get the support in Congress. I know that it's been, I think, since 1992, since the federal gas tax has been raised. So there are some that are promoting a significant increase in the federal gas tax. The question, though, is as cars are becoming more efficient, there's a reality that the gas tax in and of itself is not going to meet the needs that we have moving forward.
Exactly. I think that's an issue in Washington State as well as on the federal level. You mentioned what Congress can agree on, and right now it doesn't seem like you guys agree on much. And let's talk about money for a second, because once again, budget talks are kind of mired in partisan politics. And I'm wondering if we can put aside the bickering and the he said, she said, what are the major sticking points when it comes to reaching any kind of budget agreement.
Right. Well, and there have been some encouraging signs, I think, with the new Congress, with the new year, having the election behind us. And with that comes some optimism that a new Congress and a new year brings. And transportation, and I will get to the budget, but transportation has been an area where Republicans and Democrats historically have been able to come together and work out packages. We did last Congress, and I'm hopeful that we will again very soon even come up with a longer transportation package. But on the budget, even in the first few months of 2013, we've seen the House pass a budget. We've seen the Senate pass a budget. It was the first time in 4 years since the Senate had passed a budget. So I was very encouraged to see both the House and the Senate putting their proposals on the table. There's encouraging conversations right now going on between the chairman of the Budget Committee, Paul Ryan, in the House, and Senator Patty Murray, the chairman of the Budget Committee in the Senate. They are working to agree on what would be that top-line number so that we could go to work on the details of the budget, all the appropriations bills that make up the budget. There's a new appropriations chair in the Senate, Senator Mikulski. She has said she wants to work through each of the appropriations bills, which hasn't been happening in recent years. And I'm encouraged by this movement. I'm encouraged that Congress, House, and Senate is recognizing that we need to start at least taking some of these steps. And these appropriations bills are how we get a budget in place.
So essentially you're saying we're looking at it issue by issue as opposed to a blanket, no, we're not going there kind of thing.
Well, I think there's been a desire in the last couple of years to reach what many have termed to be the grand bargain. And I think although it was a lofty goal, a laudable goal, it was out of reach, at least at this point in time. And so taking a step back and at least starting to do some of the basics of getting a budget in place, looking at spending priorities issue by issue, whether it's defense and military, health and human services, all of education, transportation, that we in the House and the Senate start making some progress. And I think there's some encouraging signs that we're starting to make that happen. We are on the Memorial Day break right now, both the House and the Senate. When we come back, the House and the Senate have both announced that they're going to start moving forward on appropriations bills.
While we're talking about bipartisanship, before I sort of start pulling out some specific issues, the Senate Judiciary Committee just approved a bipartisan sweeping immigration reform proposal that's going to go to the full Senate. And I understand talks have begun in the House as well.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as you're concerned, what are the most important components of any kind of immigration reform? What are things that you must see for that package to get your particular vote?
Well, I believe we need to fix a broken immigration system. And I am encouraged by both the proposals that I see coming in the House and the Senate. We need to secure our border. We need to take steps to have a workable agriculture guest worker program. We need a visa reform to meet the growing demand of people who want to come to this country and pursue the opportunities that this country has to offer. America has always been this wonderful land of immigrants from every country around the world, and we want that to continue, and yet it is difficult, if not impossible, for many who want to come here to do so legally. So in the House, we are also working on legislation. We have a goal of getting a bill or a series of bills through the House by the end of June, if not July, and be able to get to conference with the Senate and get something on the president's desk by the end of the year. And I'm very supportive of that effort.
You mentioned border security, and I know that the Senate bill includes something called a Border Security Commission, establishment of a Border Security Commission. And when we talk about border, usually people assume we're talking about the border between the U.S. and Mexico. Mm-hmm. How do you see how this would apply to the border between our state, for example, in Canada? We're a border state.
Right. Well, that's I think that's an important point. I represent a large portion of the northern border between Washington State and Canada, and I've been out with border security through the years, And it's interesting because a lot of the area that I represent is wilderness or timber area, which is even harder for Border Patrol to monitor. And we've had cases of drugs that they're sneaking mm-hmm. in, or even human trafficking that is taking place along the northern border. And so I do think that it is important that we recognize that it is there are steps that need to be taken both on the southern border and the northern border.
We're not talking about constructing a fence on the northern border, though.
No, but making sure that we have the resources on the northern border to have the free flow of goods and people that are legal, but making sure that we can enforce protections and make sure that people that we don't want to have being brought into this country, mm-hmm. smuggled in this country, or criminals or drug dealers being able to sneak in on the northern border.
One of the deal breakers for immigration reform activists was they would not support a bill that did not include a pathway to citizenship. What is your stand on some kind of clearly defined path to achieving citizenship in the United States?
Right. I'm certainly in support of some kind of a path to legalization and taking the appropriate steps, especially for those, especially the children, those under 21, oftentimes who came here with their parents and didn't have any control over that decision, and then find themselves growing up in America, going to our schools, and really being a part of this country. I think we have to recognize that there has to be a way whereby the people that find themselves in this situation can become legal.
Catherine McMorris Rodgers, you're the highest-ranking Republican woman in Congress. You're the mother of two young kids. You kind of represent a new face of your party. What do you see as the most pressing issues that face working women in America?
Well, that's a great question, and I think it is exciting to see women reaching new levels in every field in America right now. I often tell people that I don't think my job is that much different than millions of other working moms in the country. It's interesting to note that we have more working moms today than ever, that the workforce has really changed in the last 50 years. That is one of the most dramatic economic as well as, I think, societal changes that has taken place, where you have 60% of moms with children under the age of 6 that are in the workforce. And so I would say that issues of flexibility, updating our laws and our regulations to recognize the changing workforce, and for working moms more than anything, I think we want that flexibility. There's never enough time in the day, enough hours in the day, and so as much flexibility that we can have to be able to do our jobs and meet the demands of our work, while also having the flexibility to figure out how to take care of the family and attend the dance recitals or the soccer game mm-hmm. or go to the doctor appointments. I think that is what women today want more than ever, and especially the changing workplace even, where you don't have to be tied to your desk as much because of technology, that you can work from home, you can with technology, you have more flexibility. And I think women really cherish that and can take advantage of that even more to accomplish their goals.
I know that is the intent behind the Working Families Flexibility Act, or one of the intents behind that. The president not too long ago signed the Lilly Ledbetter Equal Pay Act into law. A lot of women, myself included, look at the workplace and look at the pay scales and say, women are still not making 100% of every man's dollar. How do we achieve pay parity?
Well, there are laws on the books that enforce equal pay for equal work, and it is important that we are enforcing those laws, and that when you have a male or a female doing a particular job, that they get paid equal pay for that work. My concern with Lilly Ledbetter was just that the approach that was taken, where it is the trial lawyers that are going to really, I think, make out with that law, and that it would just make it more complicated and more difficult, at a very time when we're trying to get more women in the workplace and more flexibility for women.
You are a very lucky woman because you have a house husband. You're very, very lucky. I wondered if, in talking to you, do you consider yourself to be a feminist?
Well, do I consider myself to be a feminist? I do believe that I've had more opportunities, and I'm excited to see women reaching new heights in this country. I believe in equal opportunity for all. And I am someone that when I was raised, my parents always said, Kathy, you can be anything you want to be, anyone that you want to be, do anything you want to do. And I am grateful for the doors of opportunity that have been opened to me because of women in the past that have, for example, demanded the right to vote, Susan B. Anthony and the women's suffrage movement. And by the way, she was a Republican and, and someone who was a real trailblazer and opened up doors for women. And I think it's important to recognize that both Republican and Democratic women are united in this effort to make sure that women, both here in America as well as around the world, have equal opportunities. And for example, I've traveled to Afghanistan with a women's congressional delegation, and it's an annual trip that the women members of Congress make over Mother's Day weekend. I wasn't able to go this year, but we came back, and every year this group does, united in an effort to stand by women and the opportunities that we believe women should have all around the world. And I think as much as we can continue to promote those opportunities, that is going to make for a stronger economy, a stronger families moving forward, letting every family figure out for themselves how they're going to make that work, and stronger countries moving forward.
One of the interesting things that I've watched from this Washington over the past few months has been the bipartisan effort in the Senate to put legislation on the books that would help victims of military sexual assault. And I'm talking about Senator Kelly Ayotte, a Republican, and Democrat Patty Murray of Washington State. What do you see to be the impact of the increasing numbers of women who are coming to Congress?
I think there's many examples where women bring forward the important issues. And in the House, there's a bipartisan group of women that are also working on this effort. I know that freshman Republican Representative Jackie Walorski out of Indiana, she used to be a reporter in Indiana, and she was the issue of sexual assault in the military was brought to her attention while she was a reporter. And when she got elected, she said, this is one of my priorities, even before she realized that other women in Congress were working on it. But I think it's just one example of where women do bring an important perspective. We're going to have bring priorities to the table that need to be addressed, and that makes for better outcomes for everyone.
You are, as I mentioned, the highest ranking Republican woman in the House right now. Do you feel a particular responsibility, or do you feel, I mean, you're relatively young. You are still, we just talked about you being a working mom. Do you feel some sense of responsibility to the American women that you represent in that leadership role?
Well, I think it's been exciting for me to just be able to have the opportunities that I've been given, and I am grateful for that, and I want to continue to work to ensure that women all across this country know that they can have every opportunity possible, and that they can continue to reach new heights and be leaders in every field.
Republican Kathy McMorris Rogers represents Washington State's 5th Congressional District. It includes much of eastern Washington. She's the highest-ranking Republican woman in Congress, currently serving her 4th term. This is Weekday on KUOW.
How might we humans avoid being wiped out by a worldwide disaster? The dinosaurs weren't able to pull it off. Will we be able to survive? We'll find out in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Soto Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor gardening supplies and hydroponics, featuring grow lights, General Organics, Sunshine Mix, and more. Baker Creek Seeds now available, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sotohydro.com.
55 degrees in Seattle under a mostly cloudy sky. We expect to hit 62 this afternoon. Could get some brief sun breaks today, but the National Weather Service says showers are likely today and overnight and tomorrow and all the way through Thursday. Now, they say April showers bring May flowers. Okay, but what do May showers bring? That's my question for our gardening panel. What's your question? Get it ready and prepare to join us in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. We hear a lot about climate change and the urgent need to protect our planet and the many species that live here from extinction. Science journalist Annalee Newitt says there's evidence we're heading for a mass extinction, but if you take the long, long, long perspective, some life forms will adapt to the changes in Earth's atmosphere, and human beings are smart and adaptable, so we may survive too. Annalee Newitz lays this and more out in her new book. It's called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I guess we should start with a definition of mass extinction. It's not total obliteration.
It's not total obliteration. It's when more than 75% of all species on the planet die out. And these are events that usually take about a million years to happen. So it is a long view. And by the time one is over, you're really looking at a brand new planet.
So the mass extinction we're facing is actually the sixth, according to science. I didn't know about the other five.
Yeah, there have been five mass extinctions over the past half billion years. The most famous that most people have heard of is when the dinosaurs were killed off, partly by an asteroid hitting the planet and then ultimately by climate change that impact caused. And now it looks like we may be heading into a sixth.
And what are some of the clues that would lead scientists to think that that's the case?
Well, the number one clue is climate change. Pretty much the thread that unites most of the mass extinctions that have happened before is that climate change has been a big part of it. And of course, the other piece of it is that we are seeing extinction rates among animals far above what we would normally expect to see.
So you write about it's called colony collapse disorder. This is the dying bees. This scientists think is evidence of this?
Well, one of the things that's interesting about bees, and they are suffering from a disorder where sometimes a hive will simply fall apart, like all the workers will leave and they are no longer functioning. Bees are an animal which is really important to their ecosystem. So if we lose bees, we also lose a lot of crops that are very valuable. We lose the ability to fertilize fruits and nuts. And so if bees die out, we're looking at something that could cause dieouts in dozens or even hundreds of other species.
So essentially, it's the one collapse has to be looked at in connection with the sort of the dominoes that would collapse with the hives.
Right. And a bee is a major domino. You know, they're really at the center of a food web. And so that's why when we talk about animals going extinct, you can't just say, oh, well, but it's just one. It's really where they fit into their ecosystem. It may cause a lot of knock-on extinctions that you wouldn't expect.
So this potential sixth mass extinction, we're not, when people talk about greenhouse gas and climate change, it's not, or maybe it is, going to happen a whole lot faster than some of these other mass extinctions happened.
There's no evidence that it would happen faster. So one of the things that a lot of scientists believe is that we may actually be about, say, 15,000 years into this mass extinction, which again puts us still very early on in an event that could take, at the very least, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. So the question is, are we helping it along by releasing all of these greenhouse gases? And can we kind of slow it down and put a stop to it?
So we talk about greenhouse gas. There's actually the ice house atmosphere that you describe. And this was, this book starts way back, hundreds of millions of years. I can't even remember, 500 some million.
Billions of years ago.
Yeah, it's like Carl Sagan. Did you want to say that? You were practicing. So essentially, it's not been like we have been this paradise on Earth that was full of oxygen, green plants, and blue lakes.
Not at all. In fact, the planet has gone through many changes over the past 4.5 billion years. And actually, having ice on the poles the way we like it is quite unusual in Earth's history. There have been many times when we've had no ice at all, and we are in what's called a mild ice house. So humans and all of the creatures in our ecosystems prefer it to be a little colder than normal or than typical for the planet. So when we talk about doing things to reduce carbon emissions, that may not be enough. I mean, we may ultimately have to take a lot more control over the environment beyond curbing industrial pollution and really changing the way the Earth wants to evolve and how it normally would change.
But it does sound as if it's, if I were looking at a graph, that at some point carbon-loving species were more predominant and then oxygen-loving species. So that it, you know, if we're taking the billion-year view of it, it is a pendulum, in a sense, what we have on this planet.
That's right. The planet is controlled by what are called carbon cycles, and they do. Carbon cycles through the atmosphere at certain points, and that raises the temperatures, and then it cycles back into the deep ocean, which lowers the temperatures and can cause ice ages.
And this really is, this takes millions of years to happen. 15,000 is like a drop in the bucket for these things.
Absolutely it is. Yeah, the carbon cycles are on million-year scales. It's geological time, for real. The carbon cycle is what happens in geological time.
We're talking with science writer Annalee Newitz, and what was fascinating to me, you do start back in these billions of years, and you find scientists, because I'm like, well, that's great, you can speculate, but there are actually scientists. There was one, and I forgive me for not remembering where he was. There are sort of fossilized algae remains. Where do they find these things? And B, how do scientists know how old these things were and what kind of atmosphere we had just from a rock?
It's a good question. So there are a lot of scientists that work on very early periods in Earth's development, like looking back, say, 3 billion years. So the planet's 4.5 billion years old. And we started to see the rise of an oxygen atmosphere like we enjoy about 3 billion years ago. And basically, there's certain parts of the planet, a lot of them are in Australia, where you can find these fossils called stromatolites. And they look just like balls, just sort of round balls. And you can cut them open, and what you see are these little spider web lines. And those are actually algal mats from ancient history. And what we can learn from that is that these algae, what we can look at the kinds of chemicals that they processed and what they ate, and we know that they were exhaling oxygen. So we know they are kind of responsible for polluting the planet with oxygen.
Because there were so many of them, they proliferated and they exhaled so much oxygen that it makes it sound like in a week, you know, they were clogged up.
Over a billion years.
So then they made their world uninhabitable, perhaps the same way we are?
Perhaps the same way we are. And when you think about concerns over, for example, cows releasing lots of methane, it's a similar kind of thing. I mean, they basically were farting out oxygen. That was part of their digestive process. And of course, it was over a billion year period. But these algae, which are also called cyanobacteria, really did create a new planet with just the activity that they engaged in.
I have been in labs where scientists are essentially melting glaciers and measuring by the strata what kind of atmosphere that ice layer was formed in. These folks are doing the same things with the fossils, right?
That's right. So basically what you do if you want to find out how old a rock is, there's a common thing to do is basically reduce the rock to gas and then read the elements in that gas. And you can extrapolate based on the molecular composition of those elements, how long they've been degrading and what kind of environments they've been in. And basically, you basically are reducing the rock to its constituent molecules and looking at how much they've aged. And that's the basis of how you find out if you have a 3-billion-year-old rock or a 2-year-old rock.
So there's evidence for all of these five so far mass extinctions. You mentioned the dinosaurs. Is that the Great Dying, what's referred to as the Great Dying?
Actually, the Great Dying was a mass extinction. That's our third mass extinction.
Our third one, okay.
That took place about 250 million years ago, and it was caused by an enormous volcano that went off for about 1,000 years in the area of Siberia. And actually, if you go to Siberia today, there's an area called the Siberian Traps where you can see a lot of this really ancient volcanic rock there. And as a result of this massive volcano, so much carbon was pumped into the environment that you basically had the equivalent of a super industrial revolution. Mm. It was just a ton of naturally created pollution that changed the climate, cooled things down, heated things up, and at the end, 95% of species on the planet had died out.
So that really was a mass extinction.
It was the most massive. It's the worst that the planet has ever seen. It took about 30 million years for ecosystems to recover. So it was a tough time on the planet for those 30 million years.
You know, we're speaking in May, and it's the 30-some anniversary of the eruption of Mount St. Helens, which I suppose is the mini-me version of what you're talking about. And the species have started to recover. In fact, they started right away, which would indicate that life forms, maybe not all life forms, but life forms are meant to survive. They're meant to adapt. They're meant to live because they're life forms.
Yeah, that's the sort of fundamental link between all life, is that it always struggles to survive. And the each of these mass extinctions has had survivors, and from those survivors have evolved whole new ecosystems. And so what you see in the wake of a mass extinction, which is, of course, the huge version mm-hmm. of Mount St. Helens, is you see species bouncing back, and then over time, they speciate, meaning they turn into they evolve into multiple new species. And so that's how you get a complete ecosystem out of a very devastated planet.
But it also sounds like the species that managed to the 5% or whatever mm-hmm. in terms of the Great Dying and the 25% and all the other instances were the species that were the most nimble.
That's right. And the title of my book, Scatter, mm-hmm. Adapt, and Remember, kind of deals with these skills that mm-hmm. these species need to have. And indeed, the best skill you can have is, first of all, if there's danger, get away from it. Scatter. And you know, you see this again and again. The animals who can get away tend to be the survivors, and also adapt to new niches. You know, if the climate changes, figure out ways to get food and shelter.
There was a scientist who talked about biodiversity as an important thing, too. And I started thinking about, at least in commercial agriculture, the fact that we've sort of gone in the opposite direction. We're looking at monocrops on our planet, you know, farming vast cornfields or whatever. And I am no environmentalist or scientist, but it strikes me that that is counterintuitive to being able to adapt and scatter and survive.
It's incredibly dangerous. It's absolutely not what we should be doing. And a lot of the experts that I talked to for this book warned me repeatedly about the fact that we had these monocultures. And in fact, one of the only mass extinction we've had on the planet that wasn't caused by climate change was in fact caused by invasive species that created basically monocultures. And it's an incredibly fragile ecosystem if it's only made up of a few species.
So when the reintroduction of crops and fostering that diversity is maybe not going to stop the climate from changing, but it is a hedge that some things will survive.
Absolutely. Preserving diversity in land use, preserving diversity in the life forms on that land, that is a fantastically good step on the pathway towards survival.
You know, Annalee, reading your book, I could not help but think of the movie WALL-E, the Pixar film. I don't know if you've seen that.
Oh, I have. I thought of it while I was writing the book. So,
and for people who haven't seen that book, the Earth has been destroyed.
By garbage.
Lots and lots of garbage. And a cockroach has survived, a wily and tough cockroach. And the humans have gone into space. And I partly say that because that is one thing that you set forward, like perhaps we have to leave the rock that we live on and find another rock that's habitable.
It's true. And hopefully it won't be for the reasons in WALL-E where we pollute the planet. I mean, hopefully we do become better shepherds of the environment. But the planet is dangerous no matter what we do. It can explode at any time with volcanoes. We can be hit by asteroids. We could be hit by massive radiation doses in space. So we really need to have an escape plan. We need to have a place where we can go be Martian refugees if we need to. So I think in the long term, over thousands of years, we are going to have to figure out a way for humans to colonize other worlds.
I got to wonder, how long did you spend writing this and researching this book?
A couple of years. And there was a lot of traveling around and visiting people and visiting labs. And it was actually amazingly fun, but depressing.
Well, you write in the introduction that you were always somebody who liked scary films and you were kind of drawn to that. But initially, this was there wasn't a message of hope in this. You were drawn to it by the sort of disaster scenario. And why?
Well, I have always been very interested in apocalyptic stories, kind of like WALL-E in some ways. And I think that my original impetus to write this book was I wanted to write a nonfiction version of a Godzilla movie. So if you had all the knowledge that science and history could give you, what would be the worst disaster that could happen? And so I found mass extinctions, which are the worst disaster. And then it turned out that every mass extinction had survivors. And I realized, wow, even the worst possible thing that could happen to the planet is survivable. Huh. So maybe there is some hope for us after all, especially because humans, not only do they possess the traits of a lot of these survivor species, but we also have a society and a civilization which allows us to plan for the future and learn from previous disasters, which, as far as we know, no other species can do that. So we're actually doubly prepared for a disaster.
So the little algae 2 billion years ago, 2.5 billion, I think, waving their fronds in the roiling sea they didn't know the past, they didn't know the future, and they didn't have the ability to plan.
Yeah, all they could really do was adapt. And they did a great job, and they basically invented solar power because they were the first creatures to photosynthesize. So we finally caught up with them on that, and I think now we can kind of surpass them.
Are you cured of that search for the apocalyptic after all this?
No, I still like disaster movies.
Annalee, thanks for coming in. Annalee Newitz is a science journalist, the founder of the website IO9, and author of a new book called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. This is 94.9 KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
Our gardening panel is standing by, and they're here to answer your gardening questions. They'll join us in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Broadway at the Paramount, presenting Fela, celebrating the music of a man who introduced modern African music to a generation and helped shape the politics of a continent. Running May 28th through June 2nd at the Paramount Theater. Tickets and information at stgpresents.org.
56 degrees in Seattle. Forecast says we're going to reach 62 this afternoon with mostly cloudy skies and showers likely. A little bit of sun maybe here and there, but showers are likely. Overnight, looks like it's going to be rain with a low of 50. Tomorrow, Wednesday, rain in the morning, showers in the afternoon, and a high of 60.
Join KUOW for a live broadcast of Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion on Saturday, June 15th at Chateau Saint Michel Winery in Woodinville. Learn more and find ticket information on the events page at KUOW.org.
President Obama and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie strolled the boardwalk together today in Asbury Park, talking about post-Hurricane Sandy recovery. That and more of today's news in about 15 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. It is Tuesday, time for our Green Days gardening segment. In the studios with us to answer your questions about gardening in
in, I guess, clockwise fashion. Greg Rayburn, the Vashon Basin steward and co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. Laura Matter, the Garden Hotline program coordinator for Seattle Tilth. And we welcome Deborah Prinzing, a garden home and design writer. Nice for me to meet you. I know our listeners have already met you.
Great to be here.
And our phone number, because I know you have gardening questions, is 206-543-5869. 206-543-KUOW, or email us weekday at KUOW.org. And I know that the rain is welcome for plant lovers. It was watering, but also really great for weeding, right? Because it's going to loosen up those little nasty roots, let them slither out.
I think so.
Like all weather of gardening.
Do. Besides heat, that sun, you know, just...
You don't like that part, no. But the rest of it works for you?
I don't know. I was out of town for about 10 days. I came back and my flowers look fabulous, but the weeds were growing as quickly. So, yeah, I have a lot of weeding to do.
Yeah, me too. Donald emails us apropos, I think, last month's hail damage. Your panelists helped me regarding damage to our hawthorn trees. You said they're hardy. You were right. I'm happy to report trees are sprouting a batch of new leaves all over, presumably to replace those they lost in the hailstorm. Oh, joy, says Sandy.
All right, we got one right. Excellent.
Yay. Yeah, I mean, this isn't like Stump the Chump on Car Talk. Tim in Ravenna, thanks for calling. You're on the air. Tim?
Yeah.
You're on the air.
Oh, thanks. I've got a couple of azaleas my front yard that get little green in the spring here. They get little green worms on the leaves that kind of denude the leaves entirely. They kind of take them down to the new growth, especially take them down to the middle vein of the leaf. And wondering if there's a something not too heavy duty to deal with on those. I didn't know whether anything climbed up, so I did put some tanglefoot around the base, but that didn't seem to help at all.
Did you see if there was another way that they were, because sometimes with azaleas, they'll have low branches, and those can provide pretty good access for things to crawl up the stem as well.
Yeah, could it be something that flies up and lays an egg, or I just didn't know. They're kind of like little mini versions of, like, cabbage maggots, you know, those kind of green things.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like you're describing. I've not seen them on azaleas. There's a lot of different moths, butterfly, that could fly in, lay eggs, and the larva would do that kind of damage. Yeah. As far as what to do about it,
yeah.
Well, hand picking is always a first option. You know, pick off what you can of those guys. Look for egg masses. Look under the leaves in particular. A lot of times you'll see them there. And then, you know, there's not a lot that I would recommend in terms of chemical spraying. You could use something like Bacillus thuringiensis. It's BT is the shortened name for that. But what you want to bear in mind is that also it's not selective to just that particular pest. So if you have other things in the yard, other butterflies that you want to protect, you could be harming them as well. So keep that in mind.
Yeah.
A good blast of water can often do a pretty good number on soft-bodied insects too.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. Well, I did squish some of them by hand.
Yeah, that works.
They're big enough azaleas, so it's a pretty big project to go over all the leaves. So
yeah,
I think though that you guys are recommending
hand picking. Children, get some kids to help you.
Yeah, a quarter per worm. Good luck with that, Tim. Thanks for your call. Gardening is our subject right now, and Vicki in View Ridge, you have a vegetable question.
Yes, we plant the. Long, slender Japanese eggplants, and we have some basil and some tomatoes. And we've been holding off planting them into the garden because it's been so chilly at night. And just wondering what advice you could give us about when we can finally put them in the ground.
Well, you could put them in now if you want to protect them. You need some sort of plastic covering over them. those little season extenders that have the tubes of water actually work pretty well for plants like that. The water heats up during the day. And then emits heat back to the plants at night, helps warm the soil a little bit. But, you know, by June, you'll be safe. And what you'll find is that things you put out now, even with protection, sometimes don't get that far ahead of things you wait to plant. So
thank you very much.
Thanks. Good luck. No, mostly they just shiver.
Yeah.
because they just stay there.
They don't die, though, yeah. Which is a good thing. We're talking gardening with Laura Matter, Deborah Prinzing, and Greg Rayburn. Sheila says, are there any tricks to slowing or getting rid of bluebells? Deadheading doesn't seem to slow them down. Are the bulbs multiplying?
Oh, yeah.
Deborah just got this light in her eye.
There are certain people in this universe who hate bluebells. Marty is one of them. She has a, you know, hatred of those things. I think that, you know, they're so easy to pull out. And if you, I can't tell if the listener wants to just eliminate them completely. That might require digging of those bulbets.
Would you use a fork, like a garden fork, and sort of get underneath them?
Or a flat spade and just kind of slice out, you know, lift out sections of it. I don't know why you would want to do that, though. But
because you like bluebells.
I mean, it's nice to have something colorful that early. And of course, now they look quite messed up, floppy, and dead. But, you know, a month or two ago, they looked great. I don't know. Greg's squinting at me like maybe.
Because it's probably some invasive thing, right?
They can be. They can be challenging to get rid of. And when you get a big mat and they multiply. And depending on how deep they are, that's one of the problems, is that in some areas they get the bulblets are surprisingly deep, so it can be quite an excavation.
They do spread.
So they're not native, Greg, are they? They're just
not the
exotic.
Ones I'm thinking of. Bluebells is a pretty common name, yeah. But the ones I'm thinking of,
yeah,
are not.
He would like them if they were native.
Well, one time I did take, I had a big dinner party, and I had a long trough down the middle of the table, and I literally dug up clumps of these and just planted them as the centerpiece, and I looked Trey Bien. I mean, it was just like clever as could be. I just dug them up.
Okay, so listener, you could put them in little pots and give them as hostess gifts or something like that, and then tell them to keep them in the pot. Hey, Matt in Shoreline, you're on the air.
Hi there. Quick question, if I may, please.
Sure.
I've got some fairly well-established raised beds that have carrots, potatoes, and peas. And they're doing pretty well, but I woke up this morning and walked outside, and there's mushrooms all over the place. We were here yesterday, but now I'm covered with two different types of mushroom, and as I'm standing next to them, I'm looking at them going, wow, lots of mushrooms here.
Yeah. Mushroom sign of organics in your soil, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I have mushrooms currently in my witchet pile that's sitting in my front yard, comes up by itself. Moist weather, well, you know, all of a sudden you get some rain and a little bit of warmth and you'll see those guys sprout up. I wouldn't worry about them. You can just pull them out of there. Turn the soil a little bit.
Okay, so nothing to worry about there?
No, it's not going to hurt anything.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for your call, Matt. We're talking gardening, 206-543-5869. We go next to Mercer Island, and we've got Alexis on the line. Hi. Alexis?
Yeah, hi. I have a rather large piece of sloping property that has a pretty severe ivy infestation, and I don't know how to get rid of it, and then also was looking for a native plant to replace it because I'm worried about erosion.
Yeah, well, ivy's not doing much, if anything, to control erosion anyway. So what it does is it tends to hide erosion problems rather than providing enough root mass to actually hold the bank, as well as it's a great cover for rats. But it's great to hear that you are interested in getting rid of it. For sloping, is it a mature stand? Do you have lots going up into trees?
Yeah, we've been able to pull a lot of it out of the trees, but it is definitely attempting to grow back.
Yeah, you don't need to pull it down out of the trees as long as you just cut around a lifesaver ring around the individual trees. And then if you go back about 6 feet from the trunk of the tree, roll the ivy back from there. And that's a great way to start, so at least ivy won't kill your trees. Then I'd start at the top of your property and work downhill, rolling the ivy into like a big enchilada or what are those? Like a ho-ho, basically a burrito, ivy burrito, roll it into a big ball. But essentially you're going to have gravity on your side to help roll it. And when the weather's moist is my favorite time to do ivy removal. I like to do it during the winter, actually, because a lot of the other underbrush has died back.
Can I ask a question? Doesn't she need to wear some kind of protective clothing when she's doing ivy removal?
With any weed removal, you want to wear gloves because different chemicals in any plant cause a reaction. And some people have had reactions, like dermatitis sort of reactions, to getting large quantities of ivy goop on them.
Yeah, I'm Deborah's actually pointing to her mouth. I would say some protection too over your mouth and nose. I have reactions to the dusts that are kicked up from ivies, but doing it on a wet day will help you with that too.
So winter months also, the nettles aren't out, and oftentimes nettles do a good job of coming up through the ivy, and you don't discover them until
they sting you.
Yeah. So replace it with some sword ferns are great. There's lots of perennials, fringe cup, foam flower. But I'd start with some big guys. Sword ferns are a great understory plant that is a fantastic replacement for ivy.
Good luck with that project, Alexis. Thanks for your call. We travel to Stanwood. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Cool. Thanks for taking my call. I'm looking to put plants over a dry well. That we put in a large dry well, and it's just into the edge of the forest, so it has kind of bright shade. I suppose this is just like putting one over a septic field. I'm looking for things that won't reach down, you know, many feet and get into the underlying pipes and tubing. And there was rhodes and, you know, the native salal and some of the native plants there. And I was wondering about which of those I could put back. I also happen to like wisteria. I was wondering how deep its roots go. Go ahead.
Now, how deep is the, how shallow do the roots need to be?
About 2.5 feet.
Oh, I think you're pretty good with most of those, the salal and the, and Oregon grape, things like that would be fine.
I don't know that wisteria would be great to put next to a forest anyway. I think it could could be a problem. I wouldn't recommend that. You're talking about a wisteria vine?
Yes.
I don't know that would be a great application for that location. Greg had mentioned some other great native perennials. I think those would be really nice.
As well as like the previous call, sword ferns and that light shade. You can plant so many different things in light shade as far as native ground covers and perennials.
Well, those all sound good. I'm getting little starts a lot of times mm-hmm. at the local native plant sales, but just wanted to talk about any other options to consider.
Well, and I share Deborah's concern about the wisteria on the edge of a forest. I don't think you'd ever stop that wisteria. It would probably be the end of the forest once it got out there.
What about, I was just thinking about some blueberries or sort of native huckleberries. I mean, is that too shaded for some kind of fruiting edibles too?
Oh, I think the native red huckleberries and the evergreen huckleberries would do great in there, and they're beautiful, have really nice foliage. That's a really good choice.
Well, good luck. That seems like a lot of suggestions, Steve, so have fun with that. I'm just going to cram in one last email. Catherine in Tacoma says, it's the third year I've had red yarrow planted in my yard, but it's just a small bunch of sprouted leaves right now. No blooms, even stems. I see other people's yarrows blooming like crazy. It did bloom last year. It's in the full sun. What's wrong?
It's so funny. I have red yarrow. My neighbor is doing great, and mine isn't either. So I think it, you know, maybe just
a bad year for yarrow.
Yeah, or just give it a little fertilizer and TLC and talk to it. Maybe, I don't know.
I thought
that's not very helpful. I have the same yarrow envy she does.
Yeah. Yarrow envy. Well, maybe just put in a different plant in there. That went really fast. It's gardening season. So we'll be back next Tuesday. Laura Matter, the Garden Hotline Program Coordinator for Seattle Tilth. Deborah Prinzing is a garden home and design writer, and she's going to be back next week. And she's got a book out, and it's called Slow Flowers and the 50-Mile Bouquet, which sounds so fun right now because it's bouquet season. Greg Rayburn, Vashon Basin steward and co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk, thanks all of you for coming in. Our show's produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Al-Sadi. Bernard Ouellette's our engineer. Tomorrow, we celebrate the centennial of the Rite of Spring. You'll want to join us then. I'm Marcy Silman, and stay with us here on KUOW Seattle.
10:59. Home prices are up, and that bodes well for the economy. Specifics in the news in a minute. First, though, this is a test of the emergency alert system. That was a test of the emergency alert system.
Two wings of gray hair protruded on either side of her florid face, but her eyes, sky blue, were as innocent and untouched by experience as they must have been when she was 10.
I'm David Sedaris. This week on Selected Shorts, an unforgettable story by Flannery O'Connor from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 10 o'clock, KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Annie Wright Day School, committed to providing a place where boys and girls in preschool through grade 8.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.